Pain Won't Kill You. Commencement Address, Kenyon College, May 2011. Good morning, class of 2011. Good morning, relatives and faculty. It's a great honor and pleasure to be here today. I'm going to go ahead and assume that you all knew what you were getting into when you chose a literary writer to deliver this address. I'm going to do what literary writers do, which is to talk about themselves, in the hope that my experience has some resonance with your own. I'd like to work my way around to the subject of love and its relation to my life and to the strange techno-capitalist world that you guys are inheriting. A couple of weeks ago, I replaced my 3-year-old BlackBerry Pearl with a much more powerful BlackBerry Bold with a 5-megapixel camera and 3G capability. Needless to say, I was impressed with how far the technology had advanced in 3 years. Even when I didn't have anybody to call or text or email, I wanted to keep fondling my new Bold and experiencing the marvelous clarity of its screen, the silky action of its tiny trackpad, the shocking speed of its responses, the beguiling elegance of its graphics. I was, in short, infatuated with my new device. I'd been similarly infatuated with my old device, of course, but over the years, the bloom had faded from our relationship. I'd developed trust issues with my Pearl, accountability issues, compatibility issues, and even toward the end, some doubts about my Pearl's very sanity, until I'd finally had to admit to myself that I'd outgrown the relationship. Do I need to point out that, absent some wild anthropomorphizing projection in which my old BlackBerry felt sad about the waning of my love for it, our relationship was entirely one-sided? Let me point it out anyway. Let me further point out how ubiquitously the word sexy is used to describe late-model gadgets, and how the extremely cool things that we can do now with these gadgets, like impelling them to action by speaking incantations, or doing that spreading-the-fingers iPhone thing that makes images get bigger, would have looked to people 100 years ago like a magician's incantations, a magician's hand gestures. And how, when you want to describe an erotic relationship that's working perfectly, we speak, indeed, of magic. Let me toss out the idea that according to the logic of techno-consumerism, in which markets discover and respond to what consumers most want, our technology has become extremely adept at creating products that correspond to our fantasy ideal of an erotic relationship, in which the beloved object asks for nothing and gives everything, instantly, and makes us feel all powerful, and doesn't throw terrible scenes when it's replaced by an even sexier object and is consigned to a drawer. That, to speak more generally, the ultimate goal of technology, the telos of techne, is to replace a natural world that's indifferent to our wishes, a world of hurricanes and hardships and breakable hearts, a world of resistance, with a world so responsive to our wishes as to be, effectively, a mere extension of the self. Let me suggest, finally, that the world of techno-consumerism is therefore troubled by real love, and that it has no choice but to trouble love in turn. Its first line of defense is to commodify its enemy. You can all supply your own favorite, most nauseating examples of the commodification of love. Mine include the wedding industry, TV ads that feature cute young children or the giving of automobiles as Christmas presents, and the particularly grotesque equation of diamond jewelry with everlasting devotion. The message, in each case, is that if you love somebody, you should buy stuff. A related phenomenon is the ongoing transformation, courtesy of Facebook, of the verb to like, from a state of mind to an action that you perform with your computer mouse, from a feeling to an assertion of consumer choice. And liking in general is commercial culture's substitute for loving. The striking thing about all consumer products, and none more so than electronic devices and applications, is that they're designed to be immensely likable. This is, in fact, the definition of a consumer product, in contrast to the product that is simply itself and whose makers aren't fixated on your liking it. I'm thinking here of jet engines, laboratory equipment, serious art and literature. But if you consider this in human terms, and you imagine a person defined by a desperation to be liked, what do you see? You see a person without integrity, without a center. In more pathological cases, you see a narcissist, a person who can't tolerate the tarnishing of his or her self-image that not being liked represents, and who therefore either withdraws from human contact or goes to extreme integrity-sacrificing lengths to be likable. If you dedicate your existence to being likable, however, and if you adopt whatever cool persona is necessary to make it happen, it suggests that you've despaired of being loved for who you really are. And if you succeed in manipulating other people into liking you, it will be hard not to feel at some level contempt for those people, because they've fallen for your shtick. These people exist to make you feel good about yourself, but how good can your feeling be when it's provided by people you don't respect? You may find yourself becoming depressed, or alcoholic, or, if you're Donald Trump, running for president, and then quitting. Consumer technology products, of course, would never do anything this unattractive because they're not people. They are, however, great allies and enablers of narcissism. Alongside their built-in eagerness to be liked is a built-in eagerness to reflect well on us. Our lives look a lot more interesting when they're filtered through the sexy Facebook interface. We star in our own movies, we photograph ourselves incessantly, we click the mouse and a machine confirms our sense of mastery. And since our technology is really just an extension of ourselves, we don't have to have contempt for its manipulability the way we might with actual people. It's all one big endless loop. We like the mirror, and the mirror likes us. To friend a person is merely to include the person in our private hall of flattering mirrors. I may be overstating the case a little bit. Very probably you're sick to death of hearing social media dissed by cranky 51-year-olds. My aim here is mainly to set up a contrast between the narcissistic tendencies of technology and the problem of actual love. My friend Alice Siebold likes to talk about getting down in the pit and loving somebody. She has in mind the dirt that love inevitably splatters on the mirror of our self-regard. The simple fact of the matter is that trying to be perfectly likable is incompatible with loving relationships. Sooner or later, for example, you're going to find yourself in a hideous screaming fight, and you'll hear coming out of your mouth things that you yourself don't like at all, things that shatter your self-image as a fair, kind, cool, attractive, in-control, funny, likable person. Something realer than likability has come out in you, and suddenly you're having an actual life. Suddenly there's a real choice to be made, not a fake consumer choice between a BlackBerry and an iPhone, but a question. Do I love this person? And for the other person, does this person love me? There is no such thing as a person whose real self you like every particle of. This is why the world of liking is ultimately a lie. But there is such a thing as a person whose real self you love every particle of. And this is why love is such an existential threat to the techno-consumerist order. It exposes the lie. One of the heartening things about the plague of cell phones in my Manhattan neighborhood is that among all the texting zombies and the party-planning yackers on the sidewalks, I sometimes get to walk alongside somebody who's having an honest-to-God fight with a person they love. I'm sure they'd prefer not to be having the fight on a public sidewalk, but here it's happening to them anyway, and they're behaving in a very, very uncool way. Shouting, accusing, pleading, abusing. This is the kind of thing that gives me hope for the world. Which is not to say that love is only about fighting, or that radically self-involved people aren't capable of accusing and abusing. What love is really about is a bottomless empathy born out of the heart's revelation that another person is every bit as real as you are. And this is why love, as I understand it, is always specific. Trying to love all of humanity may be a worthy endeavor, but in a funny way it keeps the focus on the self, on the self's own moral or spiritual well-being. Whereas to love a specific person, and to identify with their struggles and joys as if they were your own, you have to surrender some of yourself. When I was a senior in college, I took the first seminar the college had ever offered in literary theory, and I fell in love with the most brilliant student in that seminar. Both of us liked how instantly powerful literary theory made us feel. It's similar to modern consumer technology in this regard. And we flattered ourselves on how much more sophisticated we were than the kids who were still doing those tedious old close textual readings. For various theoretical reasons, we also thought it would be cool to get married. My mother, who had spent 20 years making me into a person who craved full commitment love, now turned around and advocated that I spend my 20s, as she put it, footloose and fancy free. Naturally, since I thought she was wrong about everything, I assumed she was wrong about this. I had to find out the hard way what a messy business commitment is.